Well, welcome. Jane and I, as we said, have been in inner city ministry and city ministry for most of our ministry time. A little over 2 years, about 2.5 years ago, accepted an assignment with the General Church overseeing U.S. and Canada for compassion, disaster response, and urban work. So what you are going to do today in the next hour, we're going to discuss something that I teach a class here for a week. So we'll try to condense it and skim over it. But each January, I alternate teaching a class, theology of the city, and then the ministry of fundraising. Go back and forth. A little bit about Shepherd Community. We're both an inner city ministry as well as a church, a Nazarene Compassionate Ministry. The Compassionate Ministry today has a staff about 65, budget of $4 million on a given day, serving about 350, about 500 families impacted. And then on the church side, we have three worshiping congregations. We're over about 300 each Sunday. Just planted our first church south of us and hope to, over the course of the next few years, continue to grow, but we grow it by segmenting. The city is a very diverse area, and the city looks much different than most of us. It is, when we see, what was the city where they first used the term Christian? Antioch. Did you ever hear about the five people that started the city, the church in Antioch? So you have a Mediterranean Jew, Barnabas, who was very wealthy. You had Paul, who had nothing. You had the Ethiopian, you had the Egyptian, and then you had the one who was from Caesar's family. So you have all spectrums, a very diverse church there in Antioch, and I think it's sort of the return of where we're going with the church, right? Let me start with this quick overview, and then I'm going to talk. As an ordained pastor, I can only talk 20 minutes without taking a break, or I'll have to take an offering. So we'll talk for a while, take questions, and then I'll finish up with some thoughts. Questions are probably the best thing, so as we're going through, you want to keep track of them, and we want to be helpful. The first time a city is mentioned in the Bible. Anyone know? Or anyone know the first city in the Bible? Genesis 4. Cain's done a very bad thing, and he's on the run. But God does a very amazing thing, His grace. He puts a hand of protection over Cain. Cain has a child named Enoch, and they name the first city after Cain's son, Enoch. What was the city created for? Scholars tell us that Cain was lonely. He had broken community because he was fleeing, because he had murdered his brother. And so from the very beginning, the purpose of city was community. Now there's some interesting things that we see in the Hebrew law that talks to us about some understandings of how God ordained or expected the city to operate. There's an interesting thing that happens. It tells us, it's in Deuteronomy, that if a woman was raped in Judea, which is the countryside, they would stone and kill the man. But if the woman was raped in Jerusalem, they would stone and kill both of them. Why? The expectation was that it was consensual, because if she would have yelled for help, someone could have heard and would have responded. This is an important part of understanding the Hebrew law, God's law on the city, that if someone would yell for help, the expectation was that there would be a response. We've seen studies, TV news has done stories where someone will be attacked and folks will stand around and not, I don't want to get involved. And why do people not get involved in those situations? Yeah, they're afraid to. What are they afraid of? Well, I don't want to get involved. I might get hurt. All these other things come into play. But the amazing thing, it's the same reasons why the church is hesitant to get involved when compassionate ministries. Because it may be messy. It may not be nice and neat. Yet God's law is based on the understanding if someone yells, people will respond. You know, we read the story of the Tower of Babel, and I'm sure some of you have preached many sermons about that, but the synopsis, the Cliff Notes version, for the younger generation, Spark Notes, the idea of Cliff Notes version is that the world was one, right? And they decided, together we can build this and we can get our way to God and all this kind of stuff. And God says, that's disobedient. And so he broke community. And multiple languages came about and there was confusion. The result of sin was confusion. The result of sin is the breakdown of community. Cain is lonely because he no longer has community. Sin brought the breakdown of community. So, what's God's solution to Tower of Babel? It's the day of Pentecost. The multiple languages brought confusion, but the power of God unleashed through the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, it was a unifying factor, right? And there's some amazing things that we see in the book of Acts that we're afraid to embrace today. It's pretty radical stuff, isn't it? Jane and I and our kids have been born and raised in the neighborhood we serve in. We live, work, and worship there. That's our community. We spend lots of times with the folks we work with, right? That's our community. There's one young couple. He's now my co-pastor. They came through the program as a kid. That's where he would get his Christmas. And years before Jane and I were ever there, that's where he went. And he's now in the pastoral studies program. But he's the co-pastor. But David and Kelly are like family to us. We spend lots of times with them. When they were on a mission trip last year, Jane and I realized how old we are. We had their four kids for a week or 10 days. And it's a lot different to have a 24, 22, and 18-year-old than to have, was it 4 and 8 and 10, something like that. I got old, tired quick. But they're like family to us. We live together in community. Another premise that I want us to understand is in Genesis, in Genesis 1, it says God created everything and it was. And then the deceiver comes in, and what does he do? He perverts that, right? So he creates the opposite. Health becomes sickness. Life becomes death. This consistent pattern, right? And so I would contend to you that part of community is compassion. God is a God of compassion. He created compassion. What's the perversion of that to feel sorry for? And so if we're going to understand the theology, we do not want it based on us feeling sorry for people. We walk downtown and there's a guy there with a bucket. And what do? If you ask someone, I feel sorry for him. And so we drop a dollar in the bucket. Now, my poor wife, she has heard me talk multiple times. So some of you who are pastors, our wives are stuck hearing us talk about many times the same thing. So I want us to understand the theology is community and the theology is compassion. Those are two important principles that we have to embrace in the church. So in doing that, let's look to Jesus for some examples of how he lived that out. John 4, what happens? Woman at the well. Steve, you and I talked some time ago a couple years ago about what you were wanting to do in your community. The key is he didn't want to airdrop supplies into the community adjacent to his. The question was, how can his church embrace the neighbors there? Why would Steve and his church care about a different neighborhood that was beside them? It's the same reason why Jesus went to Samaria, because God commanded him. It says Jesus had to go, right? To Samaria, to the woman at the well. Remember that? I know you ate lunch, tired. It says he had to go. There's no good reason for a Jew to go to Samaria, except he had to go. And then he did something really, Jews don't do this. He talked to a woman. Have you paid attention to some of the strife in the Middle East even now, that we see these same laws coming to bear? It wasn't appropriate for a man to talk to another woman in public, especially if he didn't know her. And here's Jesus having a conversation, so he's at a place he's not supposed to be, and he's talking to somebody he's not supposed to talk to. And then he does this amazing thing. And so try this at Starbucks. Do you guys have Starbucks around you? Just go up to someone and say, yes, I know you're a sinner, and I know you've lived a life of sin, you've been married 5 times, and you're living with someone now. Try that and see how that works in the evangelism tool, and see if you wear a cappuccino by the end of the conversation. But Jesus immediately goes into this conversation with this woman. Now, what would society tell us? That's not an appropriate conversation. You're not being politically correct. How offensive for you to bring up this woman's life situation, right? But culture also says you shouldn't be there. Culture also says you shouldn't be talking to her. And now you're having this conversation. And so the question is, why, if Jesus is our model of compassion and of community, because he was a true community builder, why was he doing this? Because the barrier that kept him from her was this thought from the deceiver: if he really knew me, he wouldn't love me. If he knew how horrible a person I was, he would never want to have this conversation with me. He would never offer me living water. And Jesus said, yeah, I know that, but I love you. It's this amazing thing for the church in understanding the theology of why we do what we do. It compels us to go to broken people. Mark 5 is another amazing story, isn't it? Scholars tell us, let's banter this conversation. We don't know if all the disciples were with him. Some of the disciples are with him, and they're in the boat. They've just had a great time. They're high-fiving. They're like, yeah, we're on the right squad here. Yep, we're doing great. He's just done all these miracles. They're on the boat, and they look at him, and they say, where are we going, Jesus? He said, oh, right over there. And they go, oh, no, that's a cemetery. He goes, yeah, that's where we're going. No, Jews don't go to cemeteries. It's against our laws. Yeah, I know that. Do you know Jesus? There's a crazy man over there. He's naked. He runs around. They put him in chains, and he breaks them loose. One of those people's over there. And he said, yeah, I know. And that's where we're headed. Scholars tell us, you know, Jesus does a great miracle. The hog industry prices dive that day, literally. But the disciples never got out of the boat, because they weren't called to those people, right? There was a time at Shepherd Community, long 30-some years ago, where the pastor wouldn't unlock the front door of the church because those people might come in. It's scandalous, isn't it? So the purpose of church is to build community and to show compassion. And so if we continue in that thought, we see this idea in John 5 where Jesus is talking to the man at the pool of Bethesda, and he asks an amazing question. Do you want to get better? Why does he ask that question? Well, first of all, if you don't want help, I can't help you. You don't want to get better. And here's where the mistake I think the church makes. let's just say sometimes the modern church is right there with Jesus and the guy at the pool of Bethesda. He's been paralyzed 38, 39 years. We would develop a mechanism to get him in the water first. When the Son of God is standing there, we would figure out a mechanism, because what he thought was he had to be the first one in the water when it was stirred, because there was a tradition that said angels would stir the water and the first one in would be healed, right? And I think we sometimes worry about the earthly issues of our neighbors more than we do about their eternal destiny. And compassion, Jesus cared very much about the woman at the well, right? Well, you look at John 5, and he's here and he tells the guy, be healed, take your mat, that stinky thing that you've been laying on, take it with you. Later in 5, it says, sometime later, Jesus sought him out and said, stop sinning. So I want to unpack a couple of truths here. One is that everything Jesus did, his miracles were to give glory to the Father and to connect to other people. Compassion is about giving glory to the Father and connecting to broken people. It wasn't about the miracle, was it? Everyone Jesus healed died. Lazarus, he dies 2 times. So it wasn't about that act. But what he did, remember when he's getting ready to call Lazarus out, he says, so that the Father may be glorified? The woman with the issue of blood, could he have kept going? She was healed because she had faith and grabbed him, but what did he do? He stopped. And why did he stop? She was unclean. She would not have been allowed into the temple today, right? But Jesus stopped so he could create the relationship. And what I fear is that our theology becomes the Bureau of Motor Vehicles' role of compassion. Take a number. Next. Next. I was talking, and he is a friend. He was telling me what his church is doing about food pantry. Actually, I was talking yesterday to an Assemblies of God pastor in California. And he was telling me all the number of people they help every month. I said, do you pray with them? He said, no, we can't. He said, we get food and from the food bank, and they won't let us pray with them. I said, do you invite them to church? No. And it's interesting, another friend told me this similar story, but then he said, yeah, we don't want to offend them. I said, oh, fine. Just tell them it's okay, they go to hell. If I'm worried, Jesus wasn't worried about offending the woman at the well. He wanted to get right past that. It's interesting, in our theology, if we follow the traditions of our church to go to the neglected quarters of the city. Now, as we went around the room, each of you shared little different stories, and guess what? Poverty and broken people are in a lot of places these days. The fastest growing area of poverty in America is in the rural communities. In the suburban communities. The fastest growing area for hunger is in the rural communities. We know that in southern Indiana, our current home, that drug use in many of the rural communities is just rampant. It's off the charts. It's amazing how bad crystal meth in particular. Now, we live in a neighborhood that's highly violent. Third most violent neighborhood in the city. But I feel fine, because violence generally isn't random. You do bad things, bad things happen to you in the city. If you're not in the wrong place and you're not doing the wrong things. It's things that we've preached to our kids for years, right? It's true. And so I think of the city, and I think of our neighbors. And I think that the greatest destruction is that many of our folks are still living in the Tower of Babel. Totally disconnected. So city was created for community, and it's one of the most lonely places in the world. Our neighborhood's the highest rate for suicide in the city of Indianapolis. We're the highest rate for mental health issues. a lot of challenges, right? And so, who has the solution? The church does. I was with our assistant chief yesterday, and I said this to him and to our public safety director, said it many times, it's not their job to make it safe, because police can corral behavior. The church can change behavior with Jesus Christ, right? Because I think we still believe in the power of the Holy Spirit, the day of Pentecost, and the change that that brought. So what else changed? Well, it's about building community. If you feel isolated, if you feel like you're the only one, and I talk to a lot of young people who this is how they feel, no one cares. Talked to a 15-year-old one time. He and his 14-year-old girlfriend snuck in at a Sunday lunch we had. And they got into a fight. He began slamming her head down into a table. Some guys intervened and escalated into violence. 15 years old, been arrested 8 times prior to that last year. This is in October. So 8 times prior to that in 2014, he had been arrested for assault and battery, known gang connections. And he says, I'm going to go get a gun and come back and shoot you up. Juvenile court does nothing, and he lives a block from us. And it really began to change us for a while. We had to have police officers there. And we set up a meeting with him. And so we and our youth guy and 2 police commanders, and we met him at a little BP gas station that had a Subway in it. And so there were multiple officers around. He would have seen the 2 with us. And it's sort of irony, because here we are, we have this incredible police presence, and here's this 15-year-old kid riding up on a bike with his 14-year-old girlfriend on her bike. And I thought, these are kids. They're kids. We began talking to him. I said, I'll call him Bob. I said, Bobby, what do you want to do with your life? And the only thing he wanted to do, and be blunt, was to have sex with his girlfriend. That's what he told us. He's 15, she's 14, they live together. He beats her on a regular basis. The one police commander looks over and he says, can I hit your girlfriend? He said, you better not, she's my girl. And he said, why is it okay for you? And we had this conversation, and finally I took out a piece of paper and a pen, and I called him by name. I said, Bobby, here, would you write down what you want me to say at your funeral? He said, won't happen to me. I said, you know Monster? Yeah, I knew Monster. I said, it was 2 July 4th ago, Monster, 15, beat up 4 guys. No, he beat up 3. The 4th one had a gun and killed him. 15 years old, was an enforcer. I said, you knew Monster? Yeah. I said, he thought he was big and bad. I said, you think you're the biggest, the baddest, fastest, strongest? You're not. Someone always bigger, faster, stronger. He said, I can take care of myself. We began to keep going back and forth. And he said, hey, it's me against the world. And the only thing I have in my world is her. Beats his mom. Dad had beat them and they fled dad, and he's living out his dad's lifestyle. So I said, you're content with being like your dad. That's about the time we got the most emotion. He gritted his teeth. He said, I am not my father. This young boy, and that's what he was, a boy, felt like it was him against the world. My prediction is the next 2 years he'll be dead. She'll probably be pregnant. Both don't go to school. But no one cares about them. They'll tell you that. And so this epitome, we hear this thing about youth violence. We hear these issues of drug use, and it's really about a broken, lonely world where when we begin to understand our theology, it compels us to go to forbidden places. It compels us to go to those people and to embrace them in their brokenness and begin to demonstrate love to them. So the theology is one that understands how God created us, and He created us to connect to each other. Okay, I'm going to stop, take some questions, and then I have some more. So what questions do you have? Yeah, what district are you on?
Southwest.
Okay. What city are you near?
Sullivan.
Okay. So a couple things I would say is we generally do not suggest folks to create other separate 501c3s. In today's structure, they're very expensive to operate because you have to do Sarbanes-Oxley, so you have to have audits, and you have to meet all these state requirements as well as the IRS, who has been very, very difficult to work with. Grants are harder and harder to come by. And for an organization like Shepherd, who's 30 years old, it's hard for us. Here's my suggestion is to find one thing that your church can do and do it very well. Tomorrow in my session, we'll be going through practical ways to connect to community. And we'll talk and have hopefully some sharing of what different churches and groups are doing. But what I would encourage, because what we know is Jesus spent most of his time with just a few people, and we feel the need at times to acquiesce to the culture of metrics that the world has, which is numbers. So this pastor in California I was talking to yesterday, and he was telling me, he said, well, we're doing 250 families every month we're giving out groceries to, but not one's ever come to church, and they've never had the opportunity to pray with one of them. And I said, what? Well, we can't get the food. I said, well, how much food could you? He said, well, if our own church did it, we could probably help maybe 10 or 25 families. And I said, well, help them and be the church to them, because we're the church. You also bring up an issue of that maybe groups don't want to fund us because we are the church. That's increasingly going to be the case. And we're going to see that stronger. We're already losing grants at Shepherd. We've lost 3 because we have a faith statement that we would expect you to sign and live by. So it's going to be harder for us, and so that's why I'm encouraging folks to really look internally to say, what little things could I do?
So looking at the big rocks, if you will, in terms of not feeding somebody but teaching them to feed themselves, we have an organization that's come to our community led by Donna Beagle, or are you familiar with that name? Nonetheless, their basic answer to poverty is mentorship, so connecting people with mentors who can then help them find what they need and become their friend, relationships. So that seems like a big rock. What would be some other big rocks? One thing that makes me nervous is our county was the recipient of $3 million for Catholic Charities for utility bills. And within just a couple months, it was all gone. So I think whatever amount of money we budget for local compassion, it's just gone. And so again, looking at the big rocks that we should be focusing on as a church.
So I would use a term different than mentor. I would use the term paraclete. Are you guys familiar with the term paraclete? It's the Greek word for Holy Spirit, P-A-R-A-C-L-E-T-E, the one who comes alongside to help carry the load.
Right.
Now, differentiate that from mentor. One of the fear, and we have a mentoring program for kids in our program at Shepherd. I hate the term though, because it denotes that I have my act together and you don't, and so I'm going to mentor you. I like the idea of paraclete. It's a mutual journey. You know, it's interesting if we the whole power of paraclete is that Jesus left God to become equal to man, and he emphasized that by washing feet. The equality is I think the important part of it that I would call a big rock is, how do you not have clients but have neighbors? And so the if we can find ways to empower people in your church to be paracletes. So what I suggested to this pastor in California is to train his church in teams of two families to take on one family and support them for the next year with food. The problem, why do we not like that? And it's, we've outsourced compassion in many places. And we'll say, well, go down to the food pantry down the street. We just all give there. You can go there. Well, we just gave up our opportunity. Jesus never outsourced compassion. He always used it. The woman with the issue of blood, what did he do? He stopped so that he could embrace her. He stopped so that he could have conversation with her. And so what... it's got to be relational, and it's going to be messy. And I think the mindset of programs, my key thing is it building community? Is it relational? And is it bringing glory to the Father? And it's going to look different in each of our settings, because each of our settings are somewhat different. You know, what's unique to what Jane and I experience in the Near East Side of Indianapolis is going to be dramatically different than rural Indiana to, you know, a suburb of Chicago to each of your situations. So that's why I think understanding the theology is why I'm emphasizing that. Community, you know, relationship, and then the giving glory to the Father. I think we have to be proud that we're the church doing it, even if it means we help 10 families instead of 1,000. Jesus didn't heal everyone. Yeah.
Sorry, you mentioned, what did a paraclete mean?
It's the one who comes alongside to help carry the load. It's also the Greek word for Holy Spirit in the New Testament. I would say near, how close is Racine to Milwaukee?
39.
One of the most aggressive urban agricultural training programs is in Milwaukee. And I can't think of the name right now. They do amazing work. But here's an idea as churches. What if it was grow, not mow? And we recognize that all of our churches have what? Dirt. And most of your churches, I guarantee your church, never been there, was farmland at some point. And now in the urban context, we had to scrape the dirt away, bring in new dirt, because our dirt tends to glow in the dark. And, you know, 100 years of urban is tough on it. But if you can bring in that and then allow families to have plots. So at Shepherd, our son and daughter-in-law have a plot amongst other families from our neighborhood on our property.
Yeah, when lost on that, we actually toyed with the idea. We have a whole side yard, and then around us, we have 1,200 apartment complexes or apartments within walking distance, and we were going to do the community garden type thing, and especially for apartment dwellers, they don't have space like that to be able to do that. And we started the process, got the approval. I mean, we were literally ready to dig, and something just kind of hit me because I was driving down the street, and our city does that on a large scale. And I realized that we're duplicating the wheel. And instead, what we decided was we were going to actually send our people to what the community was doing already instead of creating something on our own. And now we have people who are embedded in that garden plot for that, so there's more interaction, and but we kind of almost made a pretty big mistake by doing something that was already done and instead joining with something that's already in motion.
That's a real powerful testimony to the fact is, one, each of you know your situations better, so you need to exegete. We talk about exegeting scripture. We need to exegete our communities. We need to exegete our neighborhoods. By the way, a book that I would encourage everyone to read, Cross-Cultural Servanthood. Dwayne Elmer, I think. Cross-Cultural Servanthood. It's the best book I've read on the changing dynamics of the world, and the church has to embrace that. But going back to what he was sharing, it's also very powerful when the church participates with others. We can't always do it alone. In November, the city came to Shepherd and said, we love what you're doing, but your neighborhood's got all these challenges and we need your help. And so we've created the Shalom Project, but a key part of the Shalom Project is we're bringing in all kinds of partners to help us do it. We're not recreating everything, as you said. And too many times, I think, in the church and probably in my own history, I've been that way. I'll go do it my way because it's easier if I can control it. But we show a great humility when we find and embrace others and support that.
Sorry, can you give just a coaching tip for partnerships when potentially the people you're partnering, me personally, I don't get too bent out of shape on statements of they believe, you know, because they come from different backgrounds, walks of life. But we do have people within a congregation, especially leadership, that are like, well, wait a minute, we don't necessarily believe what they believe. Yet the work is really kind of, is ultimately the hope and goal. You know?
Right.
So, I mean, one, your thoughts on that. Do we, you know, how do you deal with that? And two, how would you coach if we were to teach or, you know, kind of talk with our leadership team about the viability of partnerships, even if they're not our own faith-based or even, you know, same religious.
Yeah, I think as long as it doesn't infringe negatively on our testimony on, as we said, give glory to the Father, as long as it doesn't inhibit that. So in a case, we would not do an event that's sponsored by the local beer distributor. We do not participate in anything that's sponsored by the lottery. The lottery rapes our neighborhood. Would we work with neighbors who are not believers? Sure, because Jesus embraced broken people in their brokenness, as long as it doesn't infringe on our testimony and us being who we are. So we work within the public schools. We're not allowed to preach in there. We're not allowed to do Bible studies in there. But I don't need to in the school. If I can create the relationship, I can do that outside the school time. You know, one of the things that we did, and I encourage churches in partnership, this is many, many years ago. Jeremy's now 24, so how old was Jeremy when we did Little League? 5, 6? So it was a long time ago. So Jane's, I love baseball. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio with the Big Red Machine, and if any of you are Cubs fan, I appreciate that, people of great faith. Jane said Jeremy could play as long as I was the coach, and so we it was an experience. Yeah, you have to understand, this is the inner city league. So we have the Outlaws is a motorcycle gang in our neighborhood, and they have a step-down gang that's sort of the starter gang, if you will, called the Black Pistons, and they're coaching one of the teams. You know, I made sure our kids lost that game. But we're there, but our church sponsored a team. Why would we sponsor a team in the Little League? Because you know who else did? Well, the motorcycle gang was. Who sponsored most of the teams? Bars in the neighborhood sponsored the Little League teams. And so I spent like 3 nights a week with these kids. My favorite line was when my daughter, who was probably 3 or 4 at the time, looks at my wife and says, Mommy, why don't you have tattoos like all the other mommies? In the stands during the game. It's a good way to end. Those are things that we can do that work in. And so Shepherd Community Church was on the back of every kid's shirt on our team. We were able to invest in them. Somebody, every kid in your community is going to be mentored. The question's by who? So they're vulnerable, Wouldn't it be great if the church was the one saying we care about you and we prioritize you? Other questions? Yeah.
Still understanding that you're meeting a need, and I never have a really good answer.
Yeah, and that's really hard. And here's the thing I tell folks, you're going to be used. If you're in ministry, someone's going to take advantage of you. Now, we need to be wise, and I think you set the ground rules to how you want that to happen. You know, diapers are very precious because you cannot use food stamps. You can't buy them with food stamps. Yeah, so that's a very, very, very critically important way to connect to young moms. So I think you just set up and say, you know, they can get them once a month, they can get them three times, and that's the max. Whatever you determine that you want it to be is fine. But the key is, how are those diapers opening the door for you to create relationships? And I think with young moms, there's a lot of other opportunities there. To share, I think, a paraclete mothers who could come alongside and help them. But I think establishing some guidelines is fair. There is a program for tutoring that I highly recommend. It's called Whiz Kids. It's out of Denver, Colorado. So do any of you remember SRA Reading Labs? They were the reading comprehension, different colors. You'd pull one out and read it and take a quiz, and we used them a lot growing up. So it's a reading comprehension program, but it's on the cloud. For $75, your church can have the right to it. In Cincinnati, it's so popular, they're doing a ministry that Jane and I are friends with, the leader of. 1,900 kids inside of Cincinnati Public Schools allow churches to come in and do Whiz Kids with them. It so increases the reading comprehension scores. It's a great tool. It takes about an hour a week with a kid. They do an assessment, and then you get volunteers who will work with them for an hour a week. Whiz Kids out of Denver, Colorado. I just highly recommend it. It's a great program. Yep.
Staying in Denver for a moment, Black and Glenn Young says in their book, Art of Neighboring, that there's no issue that a city has that cannot be solved on the neighborhood level. Would you agree with that statement, or how would you modify that?
Yeah, I think what we would, and then the Shalom Project, which is about a mile square around Shepherd, 15,000 folks live. Our goal is a block captain on every block. So yeah, I think that's right. The more we can make it smaller, and it's no different in the church. You know, if you have 500 in church on Sunday, what's really the impact? If you have 500, you preach a great sermon, I'm sure. Amazing every Sunday, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
According to me.
That's right. The problem is, how much impact does he have into their lives aside from that? Very little. You know, the mayor can make all these decisions, and it's breaking it down into life groups or adult Bible fellowship or Sunday school. Anything we can name it other than Sunday school, it's still the same thing, right? Do any of you know how Sunday school was developed? Yeah, I think his name was Reith, R-E-I-T-H, in London, England. If you were poor, you weren't able to go to school. So on Sunday mornings, he would gather all the poor kids together, feed them breakfast, teach them to read and then do a Bible story with them. He was a contemporary of Wesley. And we got Sunday school out of that. Well, the idea is community. Here's a statistic. In 1977 is when the Church of the Nazarene began to measure Sunday morning worship. Until then, we didn't.
What year was that?
1977. What did we measure?
Like
Sunday school.
Yeah.
Now, I'm old enough to remember, do any of you remember the banners they would have for Sunday school? They'd give to the class that had the most, or the, and you'd hang them up. And we would actually gather in the sanctuary after Sunday school, and the pastor would go, hey, if you want to stay, I preach up here. Because people, more people came to Sunday school than stayed for church. I remember, I grew up, my parents began going to the Nazarene Church when I was about 6 months old. I don't remember it, but that's what they told me. And I can remember times, I'm the youngest of three boys, where my parents would say, boys, go out back. And someone from church in their Sunday school class had come over. They'd lost their job. They were in a tight spot. And it was my parents' time that week to help them pay their bills. And we'd stay outside until we were allowed to come in. And they would do things like food poundings. You remember those terms? I always joke, food poundings, when once we, she'd go to the grocery with the kids when they were little, and then they'd pound each other with the box of groceries to go. Cheerios on the way home. Not that food pounding, but the church embraced it. But it was not embraced on the church side. It was the Sunday school class. Community. You can't have community with 500 people. It's the smaller segmented section. So we have one of our young pastors. He, on Sunday nights, he has a group of students come over to his house who play board games, and I'm talking the really intense board games, Settlers of Catan and all these things, these strategy games. These kids, half of them have never stepped foot in church, and they probably would not feel comfortable in coming into church, but he has a Bible study with them, and then they play games and eat. It's a very unique ministry. I'm limited to about Clue, and then I'm that's maybe Monopoly, but they're playing these really intense games, and these kids love it, but it's segmented to them, and he's making a connection into a very small group. I think we saw that with Jesus, maybe, right? And I think in this attempt, we've left our theology of community to try and reach numbers, the metrics of the world. And so I really think our challenge is to go back then. If you serve two families for a year and can love them, whether they accept Jesus Christ or not, that's not our responsibility. That's between them and God. But if we've loved them and created relationship with them and shared Christ with them, that's an amazing opportunity for us. And I'm going to tell you, the world's desperate for that. There's other groups who can do better food pantries and clothing pantries and all those things than we can. What we can do is be the church. And the theology of compassion compels us to connect to broken people.
Can you talk a
little bit more about the project, how you have block chapters? Yeah. So we've done, it's a new initiative for us. It's just starting. One of the things we did is we hired a neighborhood police officer. So he actually works for us. He's a reserve officer for the city, has his cruiser uniform and everything. He's a believer, and he'll be part of our team. We'll have a parish pastor, and we have a social worker. And that team will connect with the community and take services to them. And so the officer is able to say, hey, now, we've had 10 runs to your house. We can't. What's wrong, Mom? My kids are out of control. Well, we have some folks here that want to help you. And so the parish pastor, the idea is we're going to own this 1 mile area. We've been running this idea, come to us, and we're going to go to there. Now, what's a scriptural or a spiritual version of block captains? There's this movement of house churches. It's about community. And we want to build community on a very small level. And so it may mean that two blocks from our current location, we may start another church, but it fits the that very small segment there. And they meet in this person's house or whatever. But the idea is we're going to address issues and have folks feel empowered. What we know is crime stats are going to go up. Because when folks have no hope, they don't bother to call. But we're going to turn the tide over the course of time. And we've told folks 3 years, and we think we can make a dramatic change. Roughly a mile square. It's not totally that, but yeah, 15,000 folks. 37% of the houses in that area are abandoned, burnt out, or have been torn down. So I think you went down, didn't your church go down to Eastern Kentucky, Turkey Creek? You know, it's an interesting situation. Jane and I have been down there a couple times. And the work that the church is doing there, and we actually stood 50 years ago, 51 years ago now, in the end of April, Lyndon Johnson declared the war on poverty, and he stood on this guy, Tom Fletcher's porch. Well, 50 years to the week, we were all there with the general superintendent and the district superintendent and Dwayne and Garrett Mills. And I remember the guy, Tom Fletcher, is now his son lives there, Calvin, front porch has fallen off, bottles of moonshine down the row, and he says, government promised us a lot. Nothing's happened. Can the church do something? I think that's a real powerful statement. We can bring about systemic change because we instill hope and change behavior through Jesus Christ. And so be comfortable in being who the church is.
How do we avoid flash in the pan movements? You know, I try to avoid them like the plague, but sometimes it seems unavoidable, you know?
Yeah, there was a big deal, and I know where it came from. I actually know this pastor, Steve Solgrim. This big thing of random acts of kindness. Show me in Scripture where that's from. Jesus was never random. But it became a little, it was a movement. He, you know, he wrote a couple books. He's a pastor in Cincinnati. And actually, that really hit when we were there. Well-intentioned, but I think the way we avoid it is to remember our theology. Remember our purpose. Give glory to the Father and connect to broken people. I think I'm going to have to end here in just a moment. Any last questions? I don't think the flash in the pans hold up to the theology test. Now, I've given you what I spent a whole week giving you, so I've glossed over some things and highlighted a couple other things, but I can't emphasize. We're Christian, and we've got to be clear who we are, but we've got to be connected to people in broken places and all their brokenness. Yeah, it's there's a negative side to it, because what happens is when folks make better choices, they tend to have more money. So they become a Christian, they quit doing the things that they wasted their money on, they tend to get better, more money, and then they tend to move out. And we've seen that in our ministry there. Folks who we've helped who are doing great want to get out of the neighborhood. They want to get out of that. I think part of it is what we would say is it's really between them and God. We try to encourage folks to live where they serve. Incarnational is critical. And you can't parachute in or drive in. It's hard. Our first 16 years, we lived in the neighborhood. I mean, there. We're 8 minutes from church now. we're in the very southern part of our neighborhood. We're still in the neighborhood. But it's different than being right there. And I think there's seasons too. But I do believe incarnational is critical. If I didn't live in the spot where I lived, I couldn't do it. If I lived 30 minutes away and commuted in, no respect. But as people do make better decisions, they tend to improve their lifestyle. One last thing. We don't have clients, we have neighbors. If we view it that way, it'll send a very different message. Okay. Thank you.